Hello, brothers. Welcome back for another episode of The Gentleman's Journey. I'm here today with a very special guest live from the 180th convention here at the Marriott Town Center in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm here with Alpha Sigma graduate, class of 83, Neil Lattimore. Neil, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you so much for being with us today. For those of you who don't know, Neil works actually like right here in Chapel Hill, is that right?
I work here in Raleigh.
Raleigh, that's right.
Live in Chapel Hill. Mm-hmm.
He works right here in Raleigh as the Director of Communications for an organization that we're going to hear about later called Hometown Strong for Governor Roy Cooper, former Press Secretary to First Lady Hillary Clinton and Special Assistant to President Bill Clinton during their administration, and former Senior Vice President at BSMG Worldwide. Again, thank you so much for being here with us today. We're looking forward to talking to you. First and foremost, just how excited are you to be here just for a convention, a moment? No matter what times you spend in it, you're here with a lot of alumni, a lot of current active brothers, a lot of guys who are having their first convention. It's really a one-of-a-kind experience.
It's great. In fact, in 82, the National Convention was at Alpha Sigma in Chapel Hill.
Very nice.
And it was a really great time and a really remarkable time for a number of seeing all the brothers from all over the country come in. You sort of lose that isolationism when you have a chance to meet with brothers across the country. It was really great.
I think it's just, I mean, this is my first convention. You and I talked about that before, and this is a lot of other guys' first one. I just think you don't have a better opportunity to meet a lot of guys in the same place from all these different alphas. I mean, obviously when you talk about Row Conference or other things, you can meet some from your region or some from other schools. You can travel to different alphas, but here you have everyone just in one place getting to interact with each other, speak to each other. I mean, I don't think there's something more special than that. I really don't. And again, I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful that you chose to sit down with me today. And honestly, just to open up, I would love to hear a little bit about your early life, your undergrad experience. A question we kind of like to gauge everyone we speak to is, why did you decide to join a fraternity? And secondarily, what led you to Chi Psi? Because I think once you bridge the two, a lot of people have a kind of a different answer sometimes.
You know, in retrospect and looking back at it over a lot of years now, joining Chi Psi was the best decision I ever made. Mm. And at Chapel Hill at the time, and we always hope that that's our legacy, is that the Chi Psi brothers were known as being very smart, very involved in campus activities and community activities, and sort of very out there. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that about the Lodge and about the brothers at the Lodge. So I spent one semester working on a commission, the election commission at Chapel Hill for the school, and there were about 15 people on the commission, and I would say 7 were Chi Psi's. Mm. And so it was really a turning point for me to work hand in hand with these brothers and to see their commitment not only to the brotherhood but also their commitment to activities outside the halls of the Lodge. And that was swaying for me. And so I went through Rush, got the last bid, evidently, I was told. Was happy to take it.
Save the best for last, is that how the phrase goes? Yeah.
I hope so.
It's so amazing to think about just like how set apart, you know, these gentlemen are. And like you said, what drew you away, or what drew you to them, what made you gravitate towards them was how much like they were willing to do outside of just a social setting.
Yes.
Because a lot, I mean, I think Greek life really gets that bad reputation, and I think they have for a long time. And I think it's so important that our organization really sets the tone, not only as mm-hmm. gentlemen, but just as people.
You know? That's right. I think that there was, and the other thing I will say is that we had very high standards for academic excellence. And the only time I ever got in trouble at the Lodge was when a brother thought I had made a D on an exam in which there were 12 of us in the class, and he came back from dinner and literally tossed me up against a wall and said, "How could you make a D on that class? Not again, Lattimore." I made a B in the class, on the exam, not a D. But it was indicative of how passionate the brothers were about, one, doing well academically, but two, helping everybody do well. And that was really, you know, another one of those moments where you think, I'm in the right place. These guys care about not only do they care about a fraternity as a fraternity is, but also outside of these walls, about how we're seen and how we're respected.
I think, yeah, I mean, you touched like right on it with respect. I mean, as you know, having gone through the pursuit just like the rest of us, I mean, you know, self-respect is very huge. And I also think just outside of the values itself, just making sure that we're respecting of others and each other, it fosters such an important and like loving environment. And I feel like, again, when you talk about Greek life in general, it's there's so many people wanting to tear others down. There's so many people wanting to pick on those. So if you really do think about it, like getting picked on for someone thinking you had a bad grade, and honestly, I wouldn't even call that like really getting picked on. I would call that accountability.
Yes. You know?
And I think it's healthy accountability.
Yeah.
And just to think that like that's not the culture, that's not the tone anymore, it can get, you know, a little discouraging at times. Mm-hmm. But I'm encouraged knowing that I'm here, and I'm sure you and I, you know, share that as brothers ourselves.
Yeah.
Just knowing that we're cared after, you know, we're loved here. I've talked with many guys who come from either rough home backgrounds, grew up with one or no parents, were raised by other people, and they've told me they came here and felt like a one of a kind like type of bond, commitment, like love, like stuff they never felt before, and I think that's so special, you know.
I agree.
But like moving on into that, so once you got into your undergrad experience, like what is a very, it doesn't have to be fond per se, but like what's a very important memory that you still remember to this day, a lesson, an experience? What's something like that from your undergrad experience that you really take with you into your current life?
It was the power of one equals none. And that was that, you know, as a group, we could really do a lot. Mm-hmm. We could really accomplish a lot. It may take one leader, but it took a group of us to make a difference.
Yes.
I was always drawn to the fact that as a committee, as a group, as a whole, we can do a lot together. But you can't be an isolationist. You can't be by yourself. You have to bring others with you. And one person can change. It can be a movement.
Indeed.
Don't get me wrong. Yeah. It requires those to follow you. And I think that was, for me, it was that realization that one is none, it's all together.
Yeah, that's very good. I think just, you know, people forget, I think that common analogy you hear when you're young is, you know, just a single stick by itself can be broken easily, but many sticks together, while small, won't break. Is because, you know, they move together. And I always like thought analogizing that could be silly at times, but it is very true. And I think while people can do good, you know, by their lonesome and, you know, in their own time, I think people can do good things, but just imagine like the magnitude of things that people can do together as one collective unit.
Right.
And I think that's super important. I feel like something that we forget about these days is that as people kind of progress into their undergrad, get to their junior, senior years, people become less involved with, you know, their fraternal life.
Yeah.
And I definitely think, again, this is an organization that has sought to change that within the culture,
mm-hmm.
Wanting to keep people involved, wanting to keep people, you know, adamant about their goals, their ambitions,
right.
And not forgetting about those guys as they get older, because again, a lot of people can get lost in recruitment. You know, a lot of people can become very fixated on speaking with younger guys and getting them there, and that makes sense from a standpoint.
Yeah.
But we are all, no matter our age, no matter whether or not we're in undergrad, we're all brothers, and I think keeping everyone together, keeping everyone up is super important. While you were in Chapel Hill, what were some philanthropies you guys were passionate about, or what were some forms of service you guys did together?
We did a lot of stuff around Christmas. We did, I think, Toys for Tots for kids.
Awesome.
We were also very active on campus. The Chi Psi's ran basically the orientation commission. The head of orientation commission was a Chi Psi. And so orientation for all freshmen arriving on campus was run by Chi Psi's. We ran the election board. We were student body president for, I think at one point it was 8 running years, student body president.
Mm-hmm.
We actually had brothers running against brothers.
Wow.
In fact, at one point, we both lived on the third floor of the lodge. He was running one guy's campaign and I was running another guy's campaign for president. My guy lost. But there was nothing that we wouldn't become involved in. We were always looking for things to become involved in and engaged in, and places to use our time well. But we weren't trying to overextend ourselves. We wanted to make a mark and make it well.
That's good. I feel like that being involved in as many realms as you can is so important. I can say for my own alpha, as well as many of the brothers that I've talked to from the other various alphas here this weekend at the convention, just having your hand in all these sorts of things, whether it's student government, leading some type of like group. You know, I've talked to guys who are like leading Bible studies. I've talked to guys who are like leading service projects, like individual away from their fraternity, just like in general. Being involved in that kind of stuff, I feel like it's not only rewarding for, you know, the soul, it's just, it's a very good way to get all hands on deck. It's a very good way to get people out. And I think that is super duper important, that kind of initiative. And I think it's, on top of that, it's very rewarding in general. And I think, again, part of getting the modern fraternity beyond our own, just back into a positive light, starts with service. And I think that's what, you know, not only our brotherhood has going for us, but others as well, is that if when we serve, we're resonating a more positive image of ourselves with, you know, other humanitarian groups or anything like that. And I think it leaves behind, like you said, such a strong mark. And I think that's super important. As you sort of started to transition into, you know, your graduation year of 83 and started to figure out, you know, what you wanted to do, the places you wanted to go, as the infamous Dr. Seuss says, what initially made you want to go into communication? Did you always have ambitions for that, or is it something you figured out along the way?
It was something I figured out along the way. It seemed to be, I'm dyslexic, so communication seemed like a terrible fit because it requires writing, and writing is something I don't do well even to this day. But it was a medium that I sort of thrived in and appreciated. And at Carolina at the time, there was a whole division called Radio, Television, and Motion Picture. And one of the things they taught were a lot of skill classes, like how do you uplink a satellite? How do you use satellite technology? And fast forward to when I'm working in DC at the Democratic National Committee, as in the press office, I'm the only one that knows how to do a satellite uplink. And I just graduated from college, so. So it was a lot of, they had a technical skills background teaching. That didn't make a whole lot of sense. They taught technical skills as well as like hands-on reporter skills.
Wow.
So it was pretty incredible training.
I feel like, as you know, as a gentleman who still works and is still involved in that field, I think you're starting to realize, especially with, you know, this incoming generation, that the days of specialization are over.
Yes.
You know, it's not just a matter of one or two things you're good at anymore. I mean, being able to go into a field and say you can do this, that is so invaluable to have at a company or for a group. And I think, you know, that is something to get you noticed. So when you're talking about like undergrads right now, they're looking for careers, brothers that are looking to get into something. It's all about, you know, the various skills you can possess. It can be anything from, you know, like I said, communication, web design, social media, marketing. I mean, there's just infinite areas you can be very talented in, and I think it really stands out, you know, not just on a resume, but it'll get you far places in life in general, and that's definitely something to think about. So where do you start? You talk about Washington. We've, you know, talked about obviously you know, your former titles and what you do now. What is really your stepping stone that gets you into Washington and, you know, into some of your former camps?
I went to, in high school, went to Presidential Classroom. Which was sort of changing because it was the first time going to a big city without my parents. But I was moved by how beautiful Washington, D.C. was.
It's gorgeous.
And when it came time to graduate and to start moving on and start thinking about those things, I had two cities on my list. One was New York and one was D.C. My parents were dead set against New York City. sort of heartbroken by that, but anyway, I went and talked to a guidance counselor here at Chapel Hill, and I told them, they said, well, what would you see yourself, what do you want to do? And I said, well, in 1984 there'll be a Democratic National Convention, and I want to work on that convention. And then the woman was really nice. She said, Neil, that's a great, great, great thing to aspire to. That's not where you start, that's where you end up. That was my first job.
That's kind of a funny thing. I feel like a lot of people like claim that narrative these days that like, oh, my teacher told me I couldn't do this, someone told me I couldn't do this, and look where I am now. But like a lot of times I feel like it can be exaggerated, but no. But this is for you. You say, I want to work at the DNC. I want to have this position, I want to do this, and people are looking at you almost like you're a crazy man.
Yeah.
And even though she was very kind about it, like you said.
She's very kind.
But like, just almost like being like laughed at. Yeah. And then you end up there for your first job. Yeah. Now, what exactly were your responsibilities in this press office at the DNC?
In the press office, and I don't want to be delusional to anybody that I papered the place with my resume.
Sure.
I stopped by once a week. I offered to volunteer. I offered to come in and answer phones. Mm. I offered to do anything I could to get the job, and had reached out to anybody I knew who might say something nice about me. And it was made very clear to me when I took the job that I was not a deputy press secretary. I was a press aide, and I was never to be quoted. I was to answer phones. I was to take newspapers, 12 newspapers every day, and cut them up and paste them down and write a narrative about what was in that called the clips.
Yeah.
And so the clips were all hand done and had to be done on everybody's desk by 8 o'clock. So I got in every day between 6:30 and 7.
Wow.
Did the clips and then answered the phone all day, learned to set up their events, and just sat back and learned.
Mm.
And at some point in time, the convention's kind of over the horizon coming up, and they're going to computerize records for the first time. And so I learned the computer program, and I would come in on weekends and do the literally just putting data inputting. And so a month before the convention comes up, they say, you know, you've done a great job, but you're not going. I said, okay. And they said, we're going to ship everything out to San Francisco. We don't need you there. We need you here to answer phones. I said, well, no one's going to be calling, but that's okay. I understand.
Mm.
So that was 4 weeks out, 3 weeks out. I was on a plane with all my bags packed, heading to San Francisco to take over one whole chunk of the credentialing system for the committee, because the people that were tasked with that job couldn't figure out the computer program, couldn't figure out the codes. It was their first time using the system, so
it was all new.
It was all new to them.
Yeah.
So they brought me in, and I took off with it.
It's so interesting, because I just feel like so many of the steps that are involved with, you know, entering into a career, doing something you love, are pretty much the same. A lot of people these days, I notice, don't. Not that they don't take initiative all the time, but like being like a really go-getter, going to someone, going to a mentor, saying you want to learn under them, saying you'll work for free, doing work that would be, how would you phrase it, humbling-ish?
Yeah.
Like work that like you think you're above. I mean, that is a big part of getting into somewhere. Everyone's got to start somewhere. Usually it's at the bottom. Yours was almost like you started very high up. In that higher up, you started at the bottom of that.
Very bottom.
So, but like you knew that it was a stepping stone. You knew you were trying to get somewhere, and obviously you really did get somewhere. So how do we get from you doing credentialing and data entry at the DNC in San Francisco? How do we get into that big White House with the pillars on Pennsylvania?
It happened at it. I worked on the 84 convention in San Francisco, the 88 convention in Atlanta, and then the 92 convention in New York. And after the convention was over, what do they call him? President, not elect, but Governor Clinton, for a better term, staff called me and said, we'd really like for you to join our staff. And I said, I don't really want to join your staff. I really appreciate it. Not interested. So I left New York and went back to DC, and was at home one day, and the phone rang, and it was this woman who I'd never met before. And she said, hi, this is Isabel. Maggie told me to call you, and we need you to be in Detroit tomorrow. I've got your ticket information. I said, whoa, I'm not going to Detroit for anybody or do anything. And she said, but Hillary Clinton needs you in Detroit. And I said, not going. Thanks so much. Hung up. And my friend Maggie calls me back, and I pick up the phone, and she goes, Neil, you're going to Detroit. I said, yes, Maggie, I'll go to Detroit. She was a mentor and someone I had a lot of respect for, and someone I had known since I worked at the Democratic National Committee in 1983.
Absolutely.
So it was all connections that got me to all these convention jobs, and then it was a connection that got me the call to go work on the road for Hillary Clinton. I was on the road, I was supposed to be gone 3 days, I was gone 12 days. I came back, repacked my bag, was gone another 12 days, ended up moving to Little Rock, ended up running election night for the Clintons and for the media, did all the logistics set up for that. Came back to DC, got a call saying that there was a meeting at their inaugural headquarters and I wasn't there, and where was I? And I said, no one called and told me that I was supposed to be at the inaugural headquarters, and I don't want to work on the inaugural. And again, I get a phone call from my friend Maggie, and she says, Neil, you'll take this job or you'll never work again. And she hangs up. Next day I'm at the inaugural committee headquarters. And at some point during that period of time, either George Stephanopoulos or Rahm Emanuel, who was former governor of the mayor of Chicago, and George Stephanopoulos is on ABC today, stopped by my office and they said, have you gone through your FedEx packages? This is before we had email, before we really had fax machines.
Of course.
Everything had to come in an overnight mail. And I said, no, I haven't. And they said, there's a package from the transition team and they're waiting for you to call them. And so I, excuse me. So I sorted through the envelopes and I found it and I tore it open. I peeled it back, looked at it, closed it, and I went into a broom closet and broke down and cried. I still get emotional when I talk about it, but it said, you know, President-elect William Jefferson Clinton request that you join the office of Hillary Rodham Clinton as deputy press secretary. So I came in as her deputy press secretary. I started the day the president started. His first day was my first day. I ran the inauguration for the president, Mrs. Clinton, and then the next day I walked into the White House to work. And I was there for 6 years.
Overwhelming, wasn't it?
It was, there's nothing that it compares to it, and it's hard to explain the experience of what it's like, except for it just doesn't feel real. Even stepping back out of it, the pain, the agony, the hurt, and the ups and downs don't feel real because they're so severe. The downs are so bad and the highs are so high. It doesn't feel like they should be allowed to be on the same spectrum.
Probably a bunch of feelings that you didn't know you could all feel simultaneously.
Yeah.
Again, you just say it and it just strikes me. My first day of kindergarten right there. Couldn't let go of mom's leg, couldn't walk into the school building. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, I can't imagine what it feels like. I mean, people think, you know, from the outside looking in, just off Pennsylvania behind the fence like that, and they're like, wow, like that's cool. Like, I mean, like, and you know, they're like, what a cool place. But going in there to work, going through those gates, like actually entering the building, I mean, to a staff of, you know, 93 people coming into your building every day and just feeling all of that. I can't imagine what it would have been like, and I can see like why you'd say it makes you emotional to this day.
Yeah, it does.
It's something you definitely hold on to. So kind of transitioning into your 6 years, like, you know, you talk about the ups, you talk about the downs. I have to ask about the downs.
The downs.
What would you classify as your toughest day of your 6 year tenure?
It was actually after I had just left.
Okay.
And the president admitted to his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Mm-hmm. And we had dealt with the Clintons dealt with so many controversies starting with day one. and moving all the way through, it just seemed like that there was never, it never let up. I went to the grand jury probably 10 times, was subpoenaed to go testify before Ken Starr, I think about 10 times. And that was financially draining because we had to pay for our own expenses. But the president, you believe in this man and you believe so strongly in what he's saying. And when he says, I didn't have sexual relationships with that woman, you believe him. Mm. You're scolded to believe him. You're schooled to believe him, excuse me. It was really hard. And I remember I was quoted in Time magazine as saying the president put Mrs. Clinton in a canoe and pushed her out into the rapids over Niagara Falls without a paddle. And he set her up.
I mean, I political opinions aside for anyone, just seeing that from Miss Clinton, even though obviously me not being alive, it's something I've discussed with my parents, it's something I've discussed with mentors, and it's something obviously people my age will talk about. Just knowing, I mean, because we're all human at the end of the day.
Yes.
You know, we'll get into political polarization a little later, but like we are all human. It doesn't matter who we identify with. It doesn't matter like what we, you know, believe, as long as it's, you know, permissible and kind and loving. But just the fact that, you know, you have someone there, a human being put in front of the world like that, embarrassed, scolded, you know, no matter what you think, you just, you know, your heart kind of breaks for him. And like, I mean, to this day, I can see why anyone would still feel sorry for Miss Clinton, Mrs. Clinton, that is. Yeah. It's, you know, and the fact that she remained, you know, strong, firm through it, at least in front of the world.
Right.
I mean, I'm very, you know, admirable trait. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lesson we can all take. It says a lot about pride, forgiveness, honesty. You know.
It does. I think that the one thing I tell people that say, why didn't she leave him? Mm. It's because she loved him. And she was having to watch her marriage being aired like dirty laundry out in front of the streets of the White House. People were very, very angry with her for not leaving him. She didn't want to leave him. She loved him. But I say she didn't want to leave him. There were times that she thought she was. Mm. And it was really hard. We were a small staff. We were a staff that was invited to their house, to the residence for dinner and to go to movies and to go with them wherever they went, we went. So it was extremely hard and extremely hard on her. But I think through her strong faith and her love for her husband, she stuck it through. And I think she is glad she made that decision.
I mean, just talk about, I mean, another trait we think about when we discuss gentlemen, we spoke on respect earlier, but just talk about loyalty. I mean, like, wow. I mean, you know, we obviously as a fraternal brotherhood, we don't speak too much on just, you know, marriage, you know, collectively, unless we're, you know, discussing like a potential spouse with our brothers. Mm-hmm. But just talk about like what a lesson we can learn from that kind of thing. We will have grievances with our brothers. I mean, I know if one person tells you or a brother tells you that they have not had an issue with someone, I mean, before that wouldn't be truthful. I mean, no. Of course, we all have our grievances. We all have our differences, but we are bonded by something. You know, I would say you can be argued as, you know, equally strong as a marriage, you know, something that we carry with us forever. And again, it's just showing those values. And I think just stories like that show like why we do what we do and why we are who we are. And I can't imagine kind of the just the drawback that all happened after that. And, you know, following your tenure, there's plenty of fallout with the trial and all that kind of stuff. Again, being called to Capitol Hill to testify, I'm sure, is a very unsettling feeling, even though, again, you don't really have a role in anything that personal. But it is something, you know, you worked through, and obviously you went plenty of places after those moments, and you did plenty of things, and you continue to do plenty of things. So you said that this was at the very conclusion of your tenure, the 6 years there, and then you make the transition to BSMG Worldwide as Senior Vice President.
What we do with our humanitarian dollars and with our resources It's no something no other country in the world does.
Yeah, I think when you like talk about how like people like you know view the country, like what the general consensus is, I think even with people like trying to make changes, I think people want to make certain changes because they love this country so much. Yeah. I don't think it's because they hate it here. Now, again, yeah. That's what I mean. You're a man who's been involved with lots of media. That's what those corporations want you to think, because it's what sells their ratings. It's what you know does all these different things. But like in general, this is a very strong place. This is a very wealthy place. This is a very opportunistic place. Right. And this has created a life for so many people. Like I think, especially like you know 5-6 years ago. Of course, you remember when the immigration debate was very, very, mm-hmm. you know, hot. Like people are like, why do they have to come here? Like, and when I say they, I don't know why it's really us versus them thing. Mm-hmm. We're all people, but why do they have to come here? Why do they have to fly over here? Like, why do they have to do this? No matter what you think about it, no matter how you'd orchestrate like that kind of policy, you got to understand the commonality we all share is yeah. they want to be here just like us. Yes. And there was a time where our own ancestors wanted to be here. And you know, look what happened. So I definitely think no matter how you think like people like should get here, I think everyone should generally agree that like if it's done the right way, it's done safely, there should definitely absolutely be people here while we're able. Yeah. And I think that's so, so important. And I think that also just you know fosters a bunch of other values that we talk about, whether it's equality, equity, just like a general sense of love, community, friendship, and then of course we've been spending this whole time talking about brotherhood. So it's really you know good to hear. Even though there, a lot of people will ask you about you know the downs or you know the bad things, it's good to hear that there were so many things that like positively impacted your life as well as others. And I think you know it's. You know, what you get to do, the opportunities you've had are very unique, and a very small amount of people will, you know, get to do them in their lifetime. So I definitely think you would say, and you can back me up here, I definitely you think you'd attest to how lucky you are.
Yeah.
You know, and how, you know, cool some of the things you've gotten to do are. And I think you'd hold, you know, your time in Kasai right up there with a lot of those things. And I think that's really cool too. A lot of people go off, do really big things, and kind of forget about where it all started, and you know where they found their love or their passion, but you've retained that,
and I
think that's so important. Right before the break, we just talked about your transition to BSMG Worldwide as senior vice president, and you and I spoke earlier about what that exactly entailed. But just for you know the sake of this, tell me about what that organization does and some things that you encountered there.
It's one of the country's largest and most prestigious. Not lobbying firms, but we do lobbying, but it's a consulting firm. Mm-hmm. And in our shop, we had advertising, public relations, marketing, business-to-business outreach. We created the Milk as Possible campaign. Milk is, what's the Milk Mustache?
Oh, yeah.
not Milk as Possible, but the milk ad commercial.
Yeah.
What is it called?
Is it Got Milk?
Got Milk.
Got Milk.
We created Got Milk.
Every billboard in America, yeah, everyone saw it.
We saw that. I wasn't on that team, but I was on the Microsoft team during the antitrust with Bill Gates and traveled with Bill Gates.
Yeah.
That was fascinating to how the country was reacting to the antitrust case of the Gates Foundation. I did a lot of education work, a lot of pro bono work for clients in D.C. and around the country. But a lot of my work focused on education, because that was another passion of mine, was making sure every child in this country got an education.
So important. I think when we talk about, you know, the ideas of escaping poverty or escaping bad situations, education's at the heart of it. And I think if you look back 250, 300 years plus, you talk about men who said that, like Frederick Douglass, who said, not just like our escape to slavery is education, I think the escape to any type of like system or societal boundary holding you down, I think education is the best way. Mm-hmm. And I think just promoting that, again, it fosters that equity, that equality. And again, these aren't like political things. These are basic, you know, human declarations, human rights. And I think just like all of us like working together collectively, no matter your partisanship or you know who you identify with, I think that's something possible, something viable. And I think you would agree with that as well.
Yeah.
You know? And I think it's so important that we remember that though we may believe different things as people, we are still people,
right?
Above all else. So I definitely think that's super important. So whether it was in your tenure in the White House, at BSMG, elsewhere, who would you say is the most interesting person you've probably ever met? And yes, you've met the president, I'll give you that, and you've met the first lady.
Yes.
So maybe I'll say outside of those two, because I think sure. everyone would know what your answer would be.
I think one of the most amazing people I met was Nelson Mandela. And I met him, the first time I met Nelson Mandela, he was giving us a tour of Robben Island, where he was enslaved. Mm. Or not enslaved, but a prisoner.
Prisons.
He was enslaved. And he was just phenomenal, and just such a gentle soul, and such a brilliant man. And I met him again when he came to visit the president, Mrs. Clinton, in DC, and we had a state dinner for him. This is when he was president of South Africa. And I was walking down the hall, and President Clinton was coming out of a room, and I just naturally, by my training, would stop and let the president move ahead. And he said, he stopped, he goes, Neil, come over here for a second. So he said, I want to introduce you to President Mandela. And so I reached out my hand and I said, it's an honor to shake your hand, President Mandela. You're the only man that I've ever been arrested for. Because when I was in 1983, 84, sometime around then, people were going to the South African embassy every day.
Every day.
And someone was being arrested every day. And so I was recruited to go and ring the doorbell and say, I'm here to see the ambassador. Do you have an appointment? No. What are you here for? I'm here to ask for the release of Nelson Mandela. With that, police came out of the weeds and arrested you and handcuffed you and put you in the back of a van. Yeah. And so I told President Mandela the story, and he pushed back and he said, then it is I that should be asking to shake your hand. And I thought that was the most, I was just stunned. And that's the kind of man he was. He was so generous and so poetic and so giving and forgiving. Yeah. And I've never met anyone like that since that time.
Such important qualities. Again, I mean, you just think about people who, again, just, you know, give off these such strong virtues, qualities, beliefs, anything you want to call it. And just to think that, like, there's men like that that set the example for, you know, us in general, that there's good men out there, there's good men doing good things, and that we can follow in the same footsteps and do good things for this world, even if it's not as much of a larger scale.
Right.
I don't think belittling your goals or belittling things you want to do is useful. I think it's just about tackling what you can in your own community and you know, your own philanthropies, whatever you care about. You and I have discussed how there are certain ones that have really, you know, impacted you, certain things you care about. And staying with, you know, South Africa and the rest of the continent, you said, you know, AIDS, HIV was really big for you, being involved with that. Is that something you cared about?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everyone has their thing. I think everyone has their niche, per se, and I think just following that, doing what makes you happy, and, you know, doing something for the betterment of others is all about what, you know, being a Kaisai gentleman is. Again, it's the reason we call it the gentleman's journey, and I think that's really cool. Wrapping into these last two, these are a little bit different. Neil, what is your biggest fear?
I think it's a common denominator, it's failure. Mm. I think that we all set goals for ourselves, and a goal equals failure if you don't succeed. And we're all very hard on ourselves. And I wish I could be a little less hard on myself and enjoy a little bit more of what I'm doing. But failure is something I'm very afraid of. And I work tirelessly not to fail.
I can agree with that. I can say that I've felt similar feelings. Has there been something notable in your life that has set you back? Has there been a failure that would you say has, while uncomfortable, while really nerve-wracking, has defined your life?
I've been fired from a job.
I can't imagine what that's like.
And that was really, really hard. But it was two of us and the my supervisor and I just didn't see eye to eye. And I tried as hard as I could to morph myself into who they wanted me to be and morph my work product into what they wanted it to be. And I just was not successful. Yes. And it really hurt.
But you did end up somewhere. And it, yep. Like, again, everyone has that cliche saying, everything happens for a reason. I don't like to phrase it like that.
No, but I don't.
You ended up somewhere better because of it, and mm-hmm. you ended up doing something that made you happy. So despite, you know, how uncomfortable that must have been, how disturbing it was, yeah. you know, the sleepless nights, whatever you were dealing with at the time, you ended up somewhere and you ended up doing something that was, you know, really impactful for yourself as well as others. And yeah. I think that's the kicker after all, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, lastly, so you're a man who, again, wouldn't classify yourself as this, you wouldn't, but to us, master of communication verbally, you know, public speaking, you understand what it's like to reach an audience, to pull them in. What would you say as, you know, a gentleman with a lot of undergrads, younger men, you know, about to start a career and having to meet people, having to make connections, what would you say is the most important part of opening up a verbal communication or opening up a relationship? You could say, you know, eye contact, smiles, handshakes. What would you say is really the first step to pulling someone in to beginning a relationship or a conversation?
Listening. You have to listen to what people are saying so that you can respond to them. And you have to be able to listen to what they're saying and so that you can regurgitate what they've just told you and put it into the conversation. Because everybody wants to be flattered by hearing about what they've just said to some degree. Yeah. But it's really important for you as an individual to learn to listen. Because, you know, if you're told to do, if you're given a list of things to do, no one's going to wait for you to write it down. You've got to learn to listen, and you've got to learn to listen to things that they don't say, which is just as important as what they do say. So I would say listening is the most important thing in building relationships.
Isn't that so, you know, funny though, that the first step to working on verbal communication, to establishing a, you know, conversation with somebody or a relationship is not talking.
Yeah.
I think that's so neat, and I think it's definitely something I'm gonna take up after, as well as many undergrads who are entering into the job field, who are going in for interviews or just meeting people in general. I think listening is, and for everything we've talked about mm-hmm. today, is the first step to not only, you know, creating our better self and working on, you know, things like self-transcendence. I think it's the thing just to create a better world. And so I think, you know, the listening is where it all starts.
So. Yes, indeed.
Neil, thank you so much for being with us today. This has been another episode of The Gentleman's Journey, live from the 180th Convention. We thank you guys for listening today, and we can't wait to release another episode in due time. God bless. Have a great rest of your week.